Dr. Michael Roizen.
Dr. Michael Roizen.
You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show.
You're listening to You, the Owner's Manual Radio Podcast on Radio MD, iHeart, or wherever you downloaded us from. Thanks very much for listening. I'm looking forward to this guest. The B segment, this is 959B, is John Halpern, who's author of the book Opium, How an Ancient Flower Shaped and Poisoned Our World. Not only does he have the history of this, but the book talks about some potential, what I would call, not cures, but ways around or ways to decrease the opioid addiction problem. One of the things I'm interested in is the China Wars, which he talks about. And there isn't one China War, but two China Wars, and how Britain addicted China and maybe how they're getting back at us now. But in any case, Dr. Halpern, by the way, his website is johnhalpernmd.com. Dr. Halpern, thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be here with you and your guests.
Our privilege, because we look forward to it. Now, take us to the current day where over 40,000 people a year are dying of opioid addictions. What's the difference between us and other countries? Why do we seem to have the problem, or is this just we're publicizing the problem and everyone's got the problem?
So I think everybody has the problem, everybody. And the reason for that is opiates are still essential in the pharmacopoeia. Pain is universal, and opiates are extremely important medications for the treatment of pain. If we didn't have the fentanyl, which is killing so many people because of its illegal use, but if we didn't have that available, probably a lot more people would die on the operating table because we could knock somebody out. But the body will still be in pain when you cut it. So we have to give powerful opiates to help the person to not have a heart attack on the table and to safely complete surgery. So as long as humanity needs relief from pain, we need opiates.
Well, but what's the difference? We used to have morphine and Demerol in the operating room, and we didn't have as great a risk of addiction. What do you think the difference is now? Is it just fentanyl is so much better a drug?
See, now that's the heart of the matter. What's different from the history of opium, the history of this flower, which has been part of human existence since before recorded history, the difference between this whole historical record and the present is finally this opiate problem has escaped the need to have a growth cycle of a plant. It's purely synthetic. In my region of the United States, in New England, all street heroin must be presumed to be fentanyl until proven otherwise. So where heroin is about 100 times more potent than morphine, and fentanyl is 50 to 100 times more potent than heroin, okay, how about carfentanyl, which killed 1,000 more people in just Ohio in 1 year alone? That's 10,000 times more potent than morphine. So it is exceptionally easy to overdose and die now.
Now, is this because of diversion of drugs, or is it because of, in other words, there is a problem, obviously, with diversion, that is normal prescriptions, or is it because of, illegal synthesis and sales by, we hear that it's coming in from China. What's the problem? And
so here's, indeed, a lot of it is coming in from China, but I even wonder if that's just part of the spin to try to keep us away from awareness that this is still very much a homegrown problem. So what's different today is absolutely it's about the illicit use. I mean, some people have taken heart that the numbers went down in the last year. Just the number of overdose deaths from prescription meds went down, 3,500 less deaths in the prior year. But that's still superimposed on the largest numbers of overdose deaths ever that we've had. We're still at a high. There's more people dying each and every year from opiates than from the entire Vietnam War. Right now, today, it's estimated that 130 Americans are going to die from an opiate overdose each and every day. And where we spend, you know, a new relief bill for opiate addiction signed by the current administration for an additional $8 billion, that's great. But when you look at the how much we spend on natural disasters in a year, which is, you know, 100 to 200 billion, but we have 50, 70,000 people dying from overdose deaths, which pales in comparison to just, you know, a few hundred from natural disasters in a year. We're not doing something right here. And it is very much from the illicit use. And it is not just because it's being imported. So an enterprising dealer can mail about $20,000 worth of reagents to the city in question that they want to sell in. Most of those compounds are not on a forensic watch list. None of them are Schedule One. And if a person gets busted, they're going to go to jail for a couple of years. And then in the city that they wish to distribute in, they fly in a chemist, and $20,000 worth of chemical reagents can get converted into a couple million dollars worth of fentanyl. And so you're selling it then where it was manufactured locally. That is
Now, some of that is, but there's also a lot of diversion. In other words, whether it's from hospitals or patches or pills. In other words, wasn't the addiction, or I'm asking you because in Judge Posner, who is in Cleveland, I'm at the Cleveland Clinic, so I know a little bit about this just from the releases in the newspaper, says that for example, in Ohio, there was 100 oxycodone or Percocet pills sold per person per year, including babies, for each year for the last 6 years. And I clearly haven't had my, if you will, 600 of them. So I'm wondering, those are legally manufactured, right, and somehow diverted. Or is that correct, or am I wrong in
this? That's correct. And the latest figures show that the government's gotten better lately at interdiction of illegally furnished pills that were initially prescribed lawfully. But the drive for anybody who is addicted to medications that were initially prescribed by a physician leads to the use of heroin eventually, because it's cheaper and easier to obtain, where OxyContin pills can be sold for as much as a dollar a milligram. So a single pill, 50-milligram pill, it's $50. That $50, meanwhile, buys a lot more heroin. So many of these people go on to use it, and then they're softened up because initially they will snort it or smoke it. They don't have to inject heroin. You can even orally consume it. So all these methods then groom the individual to become more addicted. I mean, nobody growing up, right, says, one day I want to become an alcoholic or a heroin addict, right? They all think that they can handle it, that they're not going to become, it's going to become a problem for them. But once it has been identified as a problem, there's physiologic dependence on it, and a person feels locked in, that they can't escape the addiction. And when right now we have, for people actually wanting treatment, for every 30 people that are seeking a residential bed, there's only one bed available in the United States.
More of You, the Owner's Manual, coming right up. But let's take a moment to talk about your health. Dr. Roizen will tell you that a common question he gets asked often is what vitamins he likes, what he recommends. Without knowing more about their needs, that question used to be almost impossible to answer. Now, however, it's easy. Go to personanutrition.com/Roizen and take your free assessment. It's a smart and easy way to get personalized supplement recommendations. The Persona Assessment is backed by the latest nutritional research and the expertise of Persona's Medical Advisory Board, which consists of 8 nutritionists, a pharmacist, and 5 medical doctors, including Dr. Michael Roizen. All the latest scientific data and nutritional research put into one supplement program personalized for you. Just take the 5-minute assessment to get your free recommendations based on your goals, lifestyle, allergies, special diets, and prescription meds. Convenient vitamin packs are delivered to your door each month. Whether you want to sleep better, have more energy, or simply stay as young as you can, go to personanutrition.com/Roizen and get 50% off your order today. Half off now at personanutrition.com/Roizen. That's R-O-I-Z-E-N.
So one of the problems, so we've cited a whole bunch of problems, one of which is the illegal manufacture. A second is legal diversion or diversion of legally prescribed. A third is the lack of treatment facilities or treatment opportunities. Let's go back, and now that we've cited some problems, and I want to end with your thoughts on remedies to those problems. But before we get there, let's go back and talk about the opium wars, or war, and it really is wars as I understand it, and why opium started and why it's so been so diverted throughout history. I mean, this is not addiction is not just an American problem, as you point out, although we seem to be publicizing it pretty well.
We're publicizing it more finely because the fentanyl craze has changed things for all of us. Number one. Number two, we have more money. And it has stayed in the news cycle rather than disappearing. Usually I'm used to seeing more attention paid by politicians on these problems around elections, and then it goes away. And we still have to take care of our patients day in, day out. But this time, I think just the numbers of people that are dying are so much more that it's just hard to just let this stay as business as usual. And the other scary thing is the this change in the human condition that we no longer are tethered to the growth cycle of the plant. It's bad enough with the plant itself. I mean, one opium poppy, just one opium poppy, contains 20,000 seeds, more than enough to start right back up all over again. And so we're not going to escape this problem through stamping out what is synthesized or grown. We're not going to get ourselves out of this epidemic from education and or needle exchanges or even offering heroin replacement, although all these measures I think are very important, including heroin replacement as an option, which has been successfully piloted in Germany, for example. I think it's about 5,000 people there that are getting heroin prescribed by a doctor under a doctor's supervision, and then they're getting treated for it. And their perspective, by the way, is those people who are heavily addicted, those are part of the drug war casualties, too. So how do we get out of this problem if what we're doing isn't enough? Well, we wrote this book in part because, you know, the old Edmund Burke statement, those who do not know history are doomed to repeat it. And we've been repeating many of the same measures over millennia.
So let's go into some of that. Tell us what the
sure.
China War was, or what we learned as the China War. We learned it as Great Britain or British subjects having opium and trying to in going through India to get to China and addicting some of the Chinese. Is tell us this true story of this, and of course your book does do that in very well.
Thank you. So, in fact, the first law is calling for the execution of a user and a dealer. It was in Imperial China. They did not want to have their population addicted to opiates. Did not. So why did it happen? And it wasn't just Great Britain. In fact, even the United States had a concession in Singapore. So the United States itself got involved with the trafficking of opium to the masses. As did France. All the major powers held sway in China. And very simply, Britain wanted Chinese tea. But you have to have something of value to trade back for an exchange. And Chinese population did not want British products en masse. Hence, let's get the a Chinese population addicted to opium.
So it was the opium that was the
money.
It was the opium that was the monetary exchange mechanism for Britain to be able to get tea, and they sold China opium.
Correct.
And then now, I understood. Now, that was way back when. How come we didn't have the addiction problem in the Americas or in Great Britain at that time, or did we, or was it just better controlled before synthetic chemists got so good?
So, how good did we get it? In 2006, there's around 500,000 Americans addicted to heroin. Today, there's close to 1 million, doubled it. And I think a lot of it has been driven because of these very potent synthetic analogs in particular. And also, as we've gotten better with interdiction, with stopping the criminal enterprises, it may have pushed then the development of more analogs. It's not just fentanyl and carfentanil. There's a dozen or so analogs that have been identified by DEA. And none of these things have been developed with, protection of human life, but they're not even then developed through the millennia of trial and error of human use when you have something that's plant-based. So they may be even more dangerous. So we have bath salts, these methcathinone analogs that derive from a much weaker cathinone, which is from the plant cot. We have synthetic marijuana without now, and all this may be because of interdiction.
Let's jump ahead, John. We're talking with Dr. John Halperin. The website, and obviously he knows a ton about opioids and the history, is John Halperin, HALPERNMD.com, JohnHalpernMD.com. John, let's propose, so one of the, we've gone over a bunch of potential things. How much is drug diversion and disposal and some way of if you will, recording or having accountability of the legal drug supply a value? In other words, when you think of 100 pills per person in Ohio for 6 years, and that's per person including kids, for 6 years, you say, meaning kids, meaning infants, so the babies, if you will, when you think of that, or 600 tablets for me and 600 tablets for my wife, when I don't think we used one over those six-year period. When you think of that, for every citizen in Ohio, that's a lot of addiction from the legal diversion of pills. I don't mean from the diversion of legally prescribed pills, if you will. How much could we stop by having accountability of that system, a better accountability, versus, if you will, how much is from other mechanisms?
So, obviously we want to prevent diversion as much as possible. But it shouldn't come on the backs of our patients with legitimate pain, and we see this, the pendulum swinging both ways. So the more oversight that you have, the more a physician may feel afraid to treat a patient merely for being in pain. And that's happened in the past when, for example, New York State went to triplicate prescriptions that you had to order from the state, and it's like 75 cents or 50 cents per prescription. Well, my doctor's like, I don't want to have to do that. By the way, in that system, you have to keep a copy of it for like 6 years and mail another copy off to the state. I mean, it's just unwieldy. That whole system was catching maybe 10 or 20 people a year for trying to doctor shop, etc. So we spend $10 to $20 million a year to catch 10 to 20 people. And trying to count number of pills, okay, that obviously we shouldn't be having hundreds of pills for every single citizen in a particular state. It certainly suggests that there is misuse, overuse, diversion, that some is being sent out of state for others, but all of that can't be legitimate. It just smacks of something that seems outrageous, right? But what we do about it, it should not be making the problem worse. And trying to undertreat pain isn't going to be much of an answer, I think, in the end either. And where the majority of abusers are buying illicit substances anyway, and where we have, through the internet, the ability to order things from other parts of the world and to encourage chemists, clandestine chemists, to synthesize something that's not even technically, you know, listed by DEA as an illegal compound, and it goes into this gray area where that's happening all the time. Have to look at this from a much bigger picture. We have, the herb kratom is available. It's illegal back in Malaysia and Thailand, but it's still legally obtained in the United States. And mitragynine, the active substance in mitragynine speciosa, the name of the plant, at low levels has cocaine-like properties. At higher levels, it has mu opioid properties. So it's addictive. But some people are using that in lieu of going to a physician. So what do we do about it?
Yeah, so what are the solutions? You propose a number of a multi-set of solutions in the book. And I don't know whether propose or describe, but what would you what would you do?
So a bunch of things. First up, methadone should be prescribable in the doctor's office. The only reason it's in a methadone clinic was because of politics of fear. It's not based in anything that's could be considered rational science. So you train doctors to be able to treat addiction and to treat our patients, then let us do so. And let us get to the patients that need these medications. That's number one. Number two, really push more medication-assisted treatment, making it more readily available. In particular, it's only in this last year that once a month buprenorphine became available. So a once-a-month injection of what's in Suboxone. Now that prevents a person then from starting and stopping, switching with heroin for a time, selling it to their dealer, diverting it then to the street, giving it to people that they shouldn't. All of that's taken out of their control. And then if they get weak-kneed about their abstinence, well, it stays in them for over a month. And that is a godsend. It's really saving lives. I think it's a major breakthroughs to have that. And then the other big things, well, one is a little bit more near-term, one's more philosophical. The near-term one is we have to stop separating these patients into the other. It's like we create them like they're the Omega Man, that they're the patient to be hated, that these are somehow less than human. But those are our brothers, our sisters, our parents, our relatives, our friends, our family, and they are us. And we have to stop trying to legislate and view these people as somehow less than. Once we can get a person to recognize, no matter how much a person feels been put down or has little respect from others, once you can identify that there is a part in yourself for you to treasure, there is the beginning of a durable recovery. Because otherwise, we have right now like this idea of just keep sending people to 12-step programs. AA and NA work. They're helpful. They're important. But are people just supposed to go to self-help groups for the rest of their lives? The whole point of achieving lasting abstinence is to deepen your relations, to deepen your relationships with others. And that will provide the lasting relief from addiction. Once we do that, are we willing to deal with the nested problems of addiction? Because if you really want to cut down the opioid addiction rate, maybe we have to address how we educate people. Maybe we have to address child poverty. Maybe we have to address how we access health care in the United States. And all of these things are complicated problems that are woven in through each other. But if we're going to place the human life above these issues or these philosophical positions, I think we'll start making substantial progress. And then the final thing is a huge goal, which is that we eventually get opiates out of the pharmacopoeia. And there are people researching, for example, very potent peptides derived from amphibian venoms and mollusk venoms, some of which show picomolar affinity for the mu opioid receptor, and it suggests that we might one day have a medication that provides significant pain relief with no issues of tolerance, dependence, or overdose. I mean, that's the real ultimate goal.
So in the meantime, I did not hear much about much of what you stated, although I think some of it was into a greater degree in the book, much of what you stated in what I would call the reduction in the supply, both from the supply of preventing diversion and the illicit supply of chemists, whether from outside the U.S. or inside the U.S. How much do you think that would matter, or do you think that's a that treatment and obviously there's a large group of people looking at a trying to find a peptide that would give pain relief without addiction. How much do you think the reduction in supply would matter, or do you think that's if you will, from time immemorial, it hasn't worked?
Well, since Richard Nixon first invoked the term drug war, the United States has spent $1 trillion on this drug war. How are we doing so far?
Well, it doesn't look like we've won much, eh?
Spent. Yeah, there's not much to show for it. And meanwhile, so many people going to jail and being separated from their families, and the cycle then repeats itself. We have all the money in the world to put somebody in jail, but we don't have the money to give them an adequate education in the community from which they came, for many of these people. Oh, but what's the only thing to show clear-cut, after study, reduction in recidivism so that you won't go back to prison? That would be education. So we're penny wise, pound foolish, and I think the problem has been with us since the dawn of time. I mean, the opiate poppy doesn't even, it can't even be found in the wild. It is only cultivated, a potent plant as a medicine, identified in Paleolithic times, prehistory, and is no longer in the wild, and yet it is woven through our cultures from that ancient time to the present. Back then, the first art representations of a drug were the opium poppy with slits cut in the poppy. And it was also used as an object for fertility because of all of the seeds contained therein. And yet, even to today, we have all these references to drug use in popular media. So things have not changed that much, and the problem continues. It's just worse today than ever.
Dr. Halpern, let me go and get your prediction for the future. Tell people we've been talking with John Halpern, M.D. JohnHalpernMD.com is the website. The book, outstanding book on the history of the problem, opium, how an ancient flower shaped and poisoned our world. It's published by Hatchet Books. Let me go in and say, if you were going to predict 10 years from now, will we still have as big a problem, and or will it be bigger or smaller?
Wow. Thank you for that. I think the problem will be different for sure, because it's always evolving, and man is an ever curious animal. And whether our need to abuse these types of drugs will be quite as embedded into all of our lives, I'm an optimist. I believe that we will see in 10 years' time some significant improvements from where we are today, partially for medications that have yet to be discovered, but partially also that I think we're getting better at treating these conditions, in part because we're finally openly talking about them like this. It doesn't follow a political news cycle. It's here to stay, and it's been like this for the last 4 years. And it's making a big difference when I have to explain treatment to parents that don't know the first thing about addiction, but have to accept that they've had a child who's addicted. Instead of rejecting the child, they are trying to find a way forward to be supportive, hopefully not with giving them too much money and other resources that wind up getting repurposed into relapse, but they're more receptive to learn. There's many more family groups in support as well. So the community is coming together, and that is the point. When you do the foolhardy, crazy thing of saying, I want to become a doctor, those of us that I believe do well never let go of our idealism. What an honor and privilege for somebody to entrust their life in our hands. It's not a job. I'm on a mission. So treatment of people with serious substance abuse problems, the message we need to get out to our colleagues is one that these patients will get better too. They just need our attention. They need respect, the golden rule. And let me remind you, because it's from the Bible, and that is, he who saves one man saves the world. And I think if all of us approach this problem with that in mind, we will conquer the opioid addiction problem.
So let me go on to another subject, if you will, and that's also part of this, is there's now a major lawsuit brought against the drug companies, the intermediate, wholesalers, and the retailers of drugs. And I guess that goes to trial in a few weeks. October 20th, I think, is the date. What do you think what do you think the outcome of this lawsuit will be, or do you think it'll get settled before trial? What do you think's going to happen?
Wow. I don't have any direct primary knowledge about the litigation or anything that's confidential or anything like that. I'm not involved with it. Just from reading what's been happening, it makes sense that these lawsuits would be enacted, because these companies have made billions of dollars off of pain, and they knew that some of it was illegitimate, and some of them promoted their medications as being less addictive when they knew that it was just as addictive. And I think those types of materials brought to trial is going to be very damaging. And whether it is sufficient to have a finding that holds them accountable for it or not, we'll wait to see. But it's obvious that there's merit to these cases when a company knowingly offered a product that's safer than it was, and with devastating results. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people became addicted to OxyContin. But there may be excesses, too. Again, we want to make sure that people who legitimately have need for a pain medication, even if it's addictive, if it's needed, that we are able to prescribe it. And the drug company shouldn't be held accountable for that. And that's where they will probably try to argue away that they didn't do anything wrong. It's up to the doctor to make that decision in the end. I think the difference is that it's just been so publicly reviewed, and some of these documents have already gotten to the public, that from a business standpoint, it may be that even if they think that they have a winning case, that they're going to lose in the court of public opinion, and they may want to settle. I'm just glad to see that we're trying to hold accountable people that have helped worsen this problem.
Great. I appreciate your being on. We're talking and have been talking with someone who is probably more knowledgeable than just about anyone in the field on the subject, John Halpern, a treating physician, a psychiatrist who spent 20 years at Harvard Medical School, not as a student, but helping people get through addiction, now is in private practice, johnhalpernmd.com, but has written a very, very excellent book called Opium, O-P-I-U-M, How an Ancient Flower Shaped and Poisoned Our World. You've been listening to You, the Owner's Manual Radio Podcast. Thanks very much for downloading us, and thanks very much for telling others about us. Randall, thank you for your engineering, but especially you, the listeners, 50,000 of you, we can't all be wrong, so thank you for doing it. Tell your friends about us. Do rate us. I learned a lot about opium. Write me at ageprooflife, Dr. Mike, at ageprooflife.com, and we'll, or it's at ageprooflife.com for the website, and we'll try and find out if you're interested more in the subject, and we'll get other experts on as well. If you say, look, I can't handle opium as a subject, that's fine. You can tell us that too. Thanks very much. And again, Dr. Halpern, thank you for your expertise and for writing such an informative and interesting book. We'll be back next week. This is 959B. Remember, the A segments are always the latest medical news of the week and what it means to you. Thanks again.